Dublin's Talking Sport with Ken Doherty and Reggie Corrigan.
Sponsored by InsureMyVan.ie. Reduce your price, not your cover.
On Sunshine 106.8.
This is the ball of Tiger Woods.
Vern, this is extremely difficult. This is one of the toughest pitches on the entire place here.
Well, here it comes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. In your life, have you seen anything like that?
Hello and a very good morning to you. I'm Reggie Corrigan and welcome to Dublin's Talking Sport on Sunshine 106.8 with thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. Well, we'll be kicking off the show as normal papers this morning, joined by our very own Ken Doherty, live from Milton Keynes. In racing, we'll have Dave Weldon from the Racing Hour podcast to preview this weekend's Easter Festival at Ferry House. The festival will feature one of the most highly anticipated races, the Irish Grand National, and he'll also share his lucky 15 for this weekend as well. In rugby, we'll be speaking to sports journalist for the Irish Independent and Left Wing podcast, Will Slattery, as he reacts to last weekend's Pro 14 final with Leinster beating Munster to claim the title. And also we'll be looking at this weekend's Champions Cup action, and of course talking about that cancelled game yesterday between Leinster and Toulon because of COVID. In GAA, we have GAA correspondent Declan Drake to discuss the 12-week suspension for Dublin coach Desi Farrell after the images of players training during COVID restrictions were published earlier this week. And in football, Alan Cawley of Cawley's Call will recap Ireland's international performances in the World Cup qualifiers, and we'll also be talking about this weekend's return to Premier League action, of course. In the comeback, the COVID-19 and return of sports this week, we'll be speaking to CEO and Secretary General of Basketball Ireland, Bernard O'Byrne, to discuss how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the sport and the clubs and how they may get back to international duty. And as usual, you can get in touch with us on the show by texting us on 087 11 55 777 or WhatsApp us on 087 188 1068. And of course, don't forget, we're on Facebook, Dublin's Talking Sport, Twitter at Sport1068 and Instagram, Dublin's Talking Sport. Well, as I said, we'll be talking to our own Ken Doherty and he's on the line now to join me. Morning, Ken. How are you?
Good morning, Reg. How are you?
I'm very well. It's absolutely beautiful here today, Ken.
Yeah, the weather's
splitting the stones.
The weather's been lovely, hasn't it, the last few days? And anyway, certainly over here, the sun has come out. There's a nice sort of spring, summer feel to it, you know?
Yeah, it's tough at the moment because it's dragging everybody outdoors and everybody's getting excited about the fact that it's so nice. And of course, that's causing all sorts of problems. But we won't worry about those. We'll manage on. No golf this week, no?
No golf this week, no. I was at a nice game last week, of course, when you rang. And now this week is off because we have the World Championship qualifiers, of course, they start on Monday. I'm playing Tuesday, so for Monday for about 14 days, the qualifiers are on. And then, of course, the World Championship starts on the 17th, on the Saturday on BBC at the Crucible with crowds, like we discussed last week, you know.
Excellent. And I believe the draw is out as well for the snooker World Championships. What's it looking like?
Well, the draw came out, and you wouldn't believe it was pulled out the first round. Jimmy White was pulled out against Stephen Hendry. They played in four finals during the 90s. I think the last one was in 1994, which is actually round nine. And now they're playing back in round one on Monday night. And it was supposed to be on the Eurosport app, but because a lot of the matches are being streamed on the Eurosport app, but because of the hype of the two of them playing after so many years, playing against each other through the 90s, and particularly in those four World Finals, that they're going to show on, I think, at Eurosport 1 or 2, live on Monday night. It's the only game that's going to be shown live on the TV, where all the other games will be streamed on the app. So it's going to be a mouth-watering clash. Like, I'm really looking forward to it myself.
Oh, brilliant. I can't wait. That's great news now. That's something to look forward to on Monday night. Yeah, because it is mouth-watering, albeit the two lads are maybe, a few more years and a few more miles on the clock than they had when they last met. But I know Jimmy's playing away the whole time and full of practice. How's Stephen Hendry looking these days? How's his form?
Well, I've been practicing with him, okay? I've been practicing with the both of them, you know, and he's made a comeback after 9 years out of the sport. Which is quite a long time, but he sort of got a little bit of a hunger back for it. He's been given a two-year wild card, so this season and next season. But he's only played one competitive match. I mean, he He only started off a couple of weeks ago with his first match all season, which was probably the wrong thing to do. He felt he wasn't right, but he probably should have come back a little bit earlier, just got a few matches under your belt, and then gone into this World Championship with sort of a better chance. But I just feel the lack of match play and match practice will maybe be the comeuppance of him, and Jimmy would be a little bit sharper. But you never know. There's going to be a lot of pressure on that. I mean, he has this... that Indian sign over Jimmy for like 10 years, basically. As I said, he beat him in 4 World Finals.
Yeah, and like I was just thinking there, what a way to come back. You're straight on Eurosport. No pressure, like, you know, bang, bang, front and centre.
Yeah, yeah, and the hype over it as well. You know, they've done numerous interviews, a lot of papers, getting involved, a lot of TV companies. And, yeah, and a lot of people, even people ringing my phone, when is it on? Is it going to be on the TV? Can we be able to see it, you know? So it's created quite an interest. I mean, I think the balls were heated up before they were put into the bag, you know. They were put in boiling water and pulled out. But there's a few conspiracy theories about the draw, but I think it's just fantastic. It was always possible it could happen, but I just think it's absolutely marvellous, and it's going to be widely anticipated for sure, you know. So that's fair. It's Monday night.
Looking forward to that. Okay, I'm sure you've been stuck in the hotel as usual, getting in between practice, so you had plenty of time to watch the sport. And Ireland during the week, you know, it was a disappointing run for Stephen Kenny's boys. What did you make of all the football?
It is disappointing. I know he's coming in for a lot of flack, you know, and a lot of people sort of coming out of the woodwork and jumping on the bandwagon, I suppose, you know, kicking a man when he's down. Look, it's going to be one of these transition periods, Reg. I mean, looking at that, you know, the documentary of Finding Jack, which was absolutely brilliant, by the way. We can talk a little bit about that. But when you see that great team that Jack had and the great players, you know, maybe just the quality isn't there for the moment. Now, he has to groom a lot of those players and get them up to speed in the ways, like, and he needs a bit of time. You know, he doesn't have the quality that Jack had or our previous manager, Mick McCarthy even. So he has to work with what he has. They're a good bunch of lads, young lads as well. And, you know, but it's going to take a little bit of time. People have to be patient. And but the nature of people aren't going to be patient. I know he's 11 or 12 games now without a win, which is quite, you know, damaging. And but a lot of people were crying out for Stephen Kenny to get the job. You know, when he was Dundalk manager and he was so successful and getting him into Europe and doing so well. But now it's like the tables have turned on him. I feel a little bit sorry for him, to be honest, you know.
Yeah, I do too. There's no doubt about it. It's a poison chalice, isn't it? You can't win. Yeah. I mean, you summed it up, in my mind, perfectly by looking at the documentary during the week with Jack Charlton. Yeah. I mean, I watched it myself. It was brilliant. We'll talk about it in a minute. But if you go back to that time and you look at where it was, like Jack came in to a very struggling Irish setup, and it took him a while to get things going. Then he had a good run of form where he had a good team under his belt and they did very well. And then in the end, it still went a bit haywire for him, you know, and then it was Jack out by the end of it. So, like, I think what people have been very sympathetic, I think, towards Stephen and the players themselves and everything else. But I suppose it just goes back to the mess that the FAI has been for the last God knows how many years, and the state of football, you know, in the sense that they haven't developed it properly at the grassroots and bring players through. I mean, if you compare it to rugby, Ken, you know, we were a shambles as well for many, many years, but it was only when the academy structures were set up properly and young players were brought through the school systems and everything else and club systems. And if you look at Leinster, for example, they're producing young players in abundance coming through and making it through onto the international scene. And like that took 20 years to put together. So it's going to take equally as long for Irish football and the FAI to get a grasp on things and try and do something similar.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. The structure in rugby, you know, we've become a powerhouse in rugby. You know, in European rugby, the way Leinster and, of course, Munster and Connacht and Ulster have been playing over the last few years, but particularly Leinster and their academies, as you mentioned. And that funding and foresight has been lacking in the FAI over the last 20 years. It was going so well for so long. And during the good times from the 80s and 90s and those World Cups, that's when all the money should have been powered and pushed into the school systems and into the academies and into these clubs around the whole of the country, you know, to promote soccer and all the youthful you know, the stages to bring them all on, and we would have had a much better team now, because that's what, when it was at its height. And we should have learned from rugby in lots of ways, but unfortunately the powers that be at the FAI, and all they want to do was take and nothing to give back.
Well, I mean, it's not in any way meaning to sound smug about rugby compared to football, but the point I'm trying to make, I suppose, is, you see, look, rugby, and I've always said this, rugby were very lucky in a sense as well, in the sense that it only turned pro in 95. So very quickly, that, you know, the IRFU recognised that, well, if we don't keep up with the big boys and if we don't put in place the structures that need to happen quickly, we'll be left behind, and it will become like football has now, because I think football has been left behind here in this country because of how well it's organised in the big countries. And you wonder if there's ever a chance to try and catch up with the likes of, you know, the structures they'd have in England and France and Italy and Germany and all these types of places, if you could ever catch up. But I suppose you have to try and at least start, but it could take 10 years to get anywhere.
Yeah, it could do. And there's no doubt about it. Look, we've produced talent year after year, you know, Irish players, but you don't see as many now in the Premiership as you used to, you know, and that's because of the lack of funding and the lack of help, you know, in our own sort of schools and stuff. So, you know, hopefully they will learn a lot from that. And for the next, like, 20 years, they've got to put lots of money where their mouth is and really put it in place and put the right structures in place to try and produce players over the next, like, 20 or so years, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the documentary was fantastic, wasn't it? It was very sad. I mean, I had a tear in my eye at the end of it, but what wonderful times we had during those, the 80s and particularly the 90s, you know? It was just incredible footage.
Ah, stop. It was unbelievable watching it. It was just unbelievable watching it. And I think it was Roddy Doyle who said in the documentary, the one thing that stands out to him and he remembers is the colour. And I mean, that is so true, because I remember people painting their houses, you know, green, white and gold. And, you know, everywhere around the city was just bunting and flags, and you know, it was amazing, absolutely amazing. Cars going down the street that were painted.
I know.
It was just non-stop fun and enjoyment. But the other part about it, and I kind of lost it at the time, I didn't realise it at the time, but it came, you know, Brendan O'Carroll was talking about it and other people talking about it in the documentary. It was a sort of a coming of age for Ireland.
It was
kind of a bit of a, you know, we're not the downtrodden, you know, race, you know, we're coming out now, and we're and it was the start of all of that. It was just a brilliant documentary.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was like St. Patrick's Day for about 2 weeks, wasn't it, during the World Cup? Every day for about 2 weeks.
I know.
But yeah, now, I mean, the footage, I mean, I remember going down to College Green when they came back after the Talent 90, you know, there was 500,000 people there.
Yeah.
But I remember being there, you know, when they came and they had the stage around College Green. It was just the atmosphere was electric. And I remember watching the matches in Renly, you know, in the 4Ps or in Russell's.
Yeah.
And just everything was shut down. It was like bank holiday every time they were playing. And it was just the atmosphere. It gave a sense of pride, a sense of Irishness again, didn't it? And I must say, Jack Charlton really brought something to the Irish bowl, the Irish team. And it was very, very sad at the end, you know, and particularly between himself and his brother, because they'd been so successful, you know, in the 1966 team, a World Cup winning team, and how they sort of parted and never really spoke towards the end. I thought that was very, very sad.
Very,
you know?
Sad.
And of course,
I hadn't realised that it had gotten as bad as that.
Yeah.
You brought that out, and it's very sad to think that that's the way that it went, and that both of them ended up with dementia as well.
Quite ironic. And why was he never given a knighthood as well? Why was all that team from 1966, the whole team, should have been given knighthoods, like, you know?
It was mad the way when you know, his wife was saying, well, I wanted to be a lady as well, you know. I mean, I didn't realise that either. That was news to me. I mean, he got Irish citizenship, but, like, Bobby was the one who got the knighthood. That was very odd.
I know. It was very strange, you know. Maybe it's just his face didn't fit. But for what they did, you know, and the service that they gave over the years, the whole team, I mean, it was only Jeff Horst, I think, Nobby Stiles may have got one, Bobby Charlton. I'm not quite sure who else. But there was only a certain amount of that team that actually got knighthoods, and I thought that was That was very, very strange. When you see some of the people who are getting it today, you know, because of who they are or what money they have or what they've done, like, you know, those guys, they should have all got it.
Coming? Won't be long.
Never.
What did you make of the situation here? Of course, all the controversy around the Dubs training.
Oh no, yeah. Poor old Desi Farrell has taken the chop, hasn't he? He's taken the fall for it. I found it very strange. You know, I don't know why they would put themselves in that sort of situation. You know, there's enough going on. The people are suffering enough at home, and to go out and train when they shouldn't have been. I thought there might have been an exception for Elite Sports, but that doesn't come into effect until next week or the week after.
The 19th of April.
The 19th, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, they went against all of the rules.
Why would they do that? Why would they put themselves into that position?
It's a
position of power that they're in and stature that they're in. You know what I mean? They should never have put themselves in that position. I'm very, very surprised, to be honest. You know, it'll be interesting to hear what Declan has to say about it. I mean, he will have the inside track on it. But also, you know, I think they have to hold their hands up and just say sorry, you know. But Desi obviously has taken the fall.
Yeah, I mean, it's very odd to me as well how they would do it, because, you know, I, like everybody, think outdoor sport should be allowed and training and everything else. I don't see any issue with it. I don't see how there's any danger. I think golf should be allowed, tennis, all that kind of stuff, horse riding, hockey, anything outdoors, I think it should be allowed. That's just the way I feel about it. But the fact is, it isn't. And these are the best, you know, team in the country for a number of years. They're going to be looked up to by, you know, thousands and thousands of people. Just how did they think they were going to get away with it? That's the bit I cannot understand.
I can't understand it, because there's always someone who knows or somebody who's watching. Tell me, Reggie, why are Dublin not allowed trying, and maybe Leinster are allowed trying?
It's very simple. It's just because of the elite status that's been given to the sport. So the difference is, Ken, they're pro rugby players who work within a bubble. So they can avoid other work colleagues and everything else. The amateur status means that, you know, the lads going training have to go into work on Monday morning or go to other people and everything else. So that's the way. I'm not saying I agree with that. But that's just that's how they define it. So now listen, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, so for example, last night the Leinster game was cancelled because the French team tested positive. One of the players tested positive on Wednesday for COVID. Even in so-called professional pods and elite status and everything else, it's still outbreaks. The game last night was the fifth game that was cancelled because of COVID-related problems in the European Champions Cup. So they're facing major difficulties. And this is a sport that, you know, as I said, have the money to be able to say to the players, right, you're not meeting anybody, you're locked up. And I believe it's pretty horrific that the Leinster setup and the Munster, all the different team setups, what they have to go through. They really can't mix with other people. It's very,
yeah,
very
yeah, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
you know, people would say, so what? They're getting well paid for it. And rightly so, that's grand. But like, it's not, you know, all roses for them. But they're, you know, that's why they're allowed to do it and others aren't. And it's still not working in that. So, but look, I mean, whether or not people are picking it up through training, I doubt very much. I'd say it's just contacts that are happening in other places.
Elsewhere. Yeah. So Desi won't be back then for at 12 least weeks, 3 months.
But it's not like, so what? There's nothing, there probably won't be anything to be back for, if you know what I mean.
Well, isn't the league? The league will be starting, I suppose, but not the championship, obviously. Yeah.
They're hoping it'll start, but they don't know yet. I mean, just hoping. So, and like I said, you can manage things from afar.
Yeah.
I'd be interested, but I'm really looking forward to talking to Declan Drake about it, because it does feel like Desi has fallen on the sword a little bit. Or is there information to say that he organised the training sessions or whatever? We don't know that.
Yeah.
We don't know any of that yet.
Okay. So, on a lighter note, I thought it was quite funny. Read the papers today about Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, when he had that little strop when he scored the winner, you know, into injury time against Serbia. But it wasn't given because they had no VAR.
Yeah.
So they couldn't see where the ref couldn't see where the ball was over the line fully or not, even though it was from photographs and stuff like that. Ronaldo thought he'd scored to give Portugal a 3-2 win over Serbia. You know, and of course because the goal wasn't given, he got into a right strop, took off his armband, threw it on the ground, and walked off. You know, before the final whistle was blown. You know.
Hmm.
But didn't somebody pick up the armband, the captain's armband? And I just heard that it was auctioned on charity and it made about 64,000 euros. Well, at least it went to charity in Serbia. And anyway, but someone was clever enough to pick it up, put it up for auction, and they made 64,000 out of it. So there's a silver cloud.
Yeah,
silver lining. Yeah.
Good end to the story.
Yeah.
I see the Premier League is back this week as well, of course.
Yeah.
You know, there's plenty of ones. But United have Brighton on Sunday, but the Liverpool-Arsenal game tonight.
Oh, yeah, there's two crackers. Yeah, there's two cracking matches, Liverpool-Arsenal, and of course you've got Man City-Leicester as well. So two cracking matches. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the Arsenal. Arsenal are playing at home against Liverpool. That should be a wonderful Aubameyang start. And what sort of team Liverpool? It's always difficult, isn't it, when the players come back from international duty, you know, because they would have played two or three matches. There'll be a little bit of fatigue for sure. And then you're straight back in. You know, you get sort of funny results. So you wouldn't know what could happen. I mean, Liverpool might actually win this weekend, Reggie. You know that?
Their goose is cooked now at this stage. They've had their time. We need to get back. I agree with you. I think, but sometimes I think when they come back from international duty, the games, the Premier League matches go up in quality, because it's like as if they've had a bit of a breath of fresh air, the players, and they're happy to be away, and then they come back and they're happy to be back again, and the games are usually good, so I'm hoping that's the way it's going to be.
It's like being away from home, you know, for a couple of weeks holiday, and then you're looking forward to getting home, and then when you get home, you sort of wish you were back on holiday again.
I know. I wish I was on holidays at the moment, like everybody else in the country, that's for sure, no doubt about it. So who have you got, what's your thing in the
snooker? I'm playing a guy called Lee Walker on Tuesday morning at 9:30. That's my first match. I've got to win four matches. Then if I win that, I play Nigel Bond, who's been around as long as you and I have, you know. So So I'm looking forward to that match now, 9:30 on Tuesday morning. I scored a 1.47, believe it or not, in practice the other day.
I've been practicing at the Ding Junhui Academy.
I posted the last time I got a 1.47, it was a bus, and it's probably not far from the truth, like, you know. But
I watched you doing it one day. I remember.
Oh, that's right, down at the Radisson.
You got it in 5 or 6 minutes. A good quick one as well. I couldn't believe it. I have to say now, for anybody that's like, you know, snooker fan, but I'd never ever seen one live. It was amazing to watch. And I know it was only in the Radisson, but it was absolutely astounding to watch it. But, you know, it's funny. I tell our listeners, Ken, we were doing a little competition for, I think it was for our listeners at the time or whatever, but somebody won a chance to come in and play a frame of snooker with Ken. Your man broke. Ken got up and hit a 1.47. The only shot your man got was to break off the balls. Like, great competition that was.
Yeah, he stood there. He stood in the corner with the cue in his hand and never moved, did he?
I know, absolutely brilliant. You know, a great little story for him to be able to tell everybody, though, you know. To your credit, you racked him up again and gave him another frame.
I remember. I was at an exhibition once up in Drogheda, and Jimmy White was playing, and somebody had paid £500 to play Jimmy White one frame. And Jimmy is like one of those, like, you know, come the end of the night, he's trying to get out as quickly as possible, you know. But sort of, he was sort of forced into it because the £500 was going for charity, you know. So he sort of, you know, the crowd were egging him on, go on, Jimmy, go on. So, like, okay. Begrudgingly, he sort of played the last frame. So in a fit, Jimmy says, I'll break. So he broke off. He hit the cue ball from the top cushion into the back of the pack at 100 miles an hour. And a red went into the middle pocket, and he went on to make a 1.47 break. Your man paid £500. Didn't even get a shot. Didn't even break off.
Brilliant.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's Jimmy for you, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Well, listen, the best of luck to you now. I'm looking forward to that one with Jimmy and Stephen on Monday night,
on Eurosport.
And I'm looking forward to it. Yours is on the app, I presume.
I'll be on the app, yeah. I've been relegated to the app, yeah.
All right, that's no problem. I'm on the app anyway. All right.
Okay. Listen, have a good Easter to you and all your listeners. Happy Easter, and I'll speak to you next week.
No problem at all. Take care of yourself.
All right, Reg. Take care. Ken. God bless.
Bye-bye. So that's our own Ken Doherty there. giving us all of the latest from Milton Keynes. And of course, as he said, he is in action next week in qualification for the World Championships. And don't miss that one with Jimmy White and Stephen Hendry on Monday night. That'll be an absolute cracker. As part of our chats to various organisations about getting ready for comeback from COVID and how it's affected their sports, I'm delighted to be joined now on the line by the Secretary General and CEO for Basketball Ireland, Bernard O'Byrne. Good morning, Bernard. How are you?
Good morning, Reggie. How's things?
Things are good, thank you. Thanks for joining us this morning. Really trying to get an insight into how everybody's being affected by this horrible pandemic that we're going through. And yeah, it's been a tough year, no question about it. Sports suspended again for basketball back in October. But it's still a little bit up into the air as to when you're actually going to get back, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And especially, you know, with indoor sports, I suppose we feel that we are not being given proper consideration as well, and that's making it tough. I mean, as you say, we haven't bounced a ball, so to speak, since last March. There was some activity during the summer, but it wasn't formal competition. So it's been tough on everybody, you know, right from, you know, the young kids who have flocked to basketball in recent years, right up to our senior teams who are trying to think about European championships at the end of June or in July. The only thing that's certain is that there's total uncertainty, you know.
It's incredibly difficult, there's no doubt about it. My two kids are big basketball players and fans. Three of my kids are, but the two elder ones in particular are into it. And I know from bringing them to the setup before you were closed down, the steps that were taken and everything else, it, even though it was indoors, it still felt pretty safe to me. So it's really frustrating, I can imagine.
Well,
I suppose the big question then is how is this affecting your clubs? I mean, and it's such a huge sport in Ireland, funding-wise and everything else. Are they really struggling?
Well, I suppose on the financial side, actually, I won't say it's not a worry for us, but, you know, we have coped and we've put measures in place. So I don't think anybody's really focusing on the financial side. And, I mean, I think we have to acknowledge, you know, that the government and Sport Ireland did put resilience funds in place when, you know, all the bodies went to them and said if they didn't, there'd be just a total collapse of the infrastructure of sport. Mm-hmm. So they did that, and, you know, we were able to batten down the hatches, and we've been able to help every one of our clubs around the country. So I don't think this is not about finance at all. You know, this is about playing the game. It's about mental health. It's about, you know, wanting to prevent a drift away from the sport, you know, that outdoor sports. Kids are now next week going to be able to train outdoor with GAA, and the basketball court beside the GAA pitch is closed, or the facility is closed, and we think unreasonably so. You know, I'm on the European Board of Basketball, Reggie, and I know firsthand what's going on around Europe, and I have to say that we are outliers in terms of the medical advice that seems to be for indoor sport in Ireland and what's applying around Europe, where most of the leagues have continued to go on, some of them in bubbles at the professional end, but even, you know, at local club end. I was talking to a friend of mine in Spain whose three sons under 16 have played basketball through the pandemic, and they have 500 members in that club, and they've had two cases. And the reason that's happening is that, you know, the people organizing the sport are trustworthy, and they take all the possible precautions, because the last thing that they want is, you know, for something to happen that can be pinned, if you like, on basketball. And that's really all we're asking, that, you know, the health authorities and the government authorities would look at the evidence. And the evidence around Europe does not support a blanket close down of basketball, and indeed indoor sport. Don't forget, there are 25 national governing bodies who either totally play indoors or part of their sports are indoors. So it's a huge cohort of people. It's not just the basketball fraternity.
And, you know, are you getting a reaction to that? I believe you have a meeting with the minister, Jack Chambers, next week. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, in fairness, you know, we're trying to, you know, we don't want to be arguing with government ministers. You know yourself, you know, that's a no-win situation. Yeah. But in fairness, you know, we've already met with Minister Chambers three times. We've got a good hearing. Before Christmas, he asked us to make a presentation to him, a document, all the NGBs, and we sent in a very comprehensive document outlining how we could come back in a structured fashion. So they have that before Christmas. But I was really frustrated earlier in the week, you know, 3 months after submitting that, when, you know, the Taoiseach makes an announcement and really there's nothing about indoor sport in it. You know, all we're looking for here is a pathway. We're not saying you can go back playing next Monday. We realise that's not feasible. But if there was a pathway with some dates in that, you know, our international teams could open first, then maybe our National League teams, and then on to schools and clubs later in the year, then you have a pathway, you have something to aim for. And we all understand the uncertainty that there might be a fourth wave or whatever. But at the moment, we're completely in limbo. It feels as though the lights are just completely turned off and we have no idea where we're going.
Do you feel, Bernard, as many seem to, that all of these meetings and everything else are just a waste of time, in the sense that, you know, everybody wants a pathway? So hospitality is looking for one, tourism is looking for one, you can go on the list of things. And then within sport itself, there are so many other sports, you know, whether it be hockey or boxing or athletics or whatever, that are in the same situation. Do you think the government are just, like, you know, just playing along with it and meeting you, but there's nothing's ever going to come of it?
I suppose it'd be, you can say that, Reggie, yeah. It'd be dangerous for me to say it, you know, but I mean, I suppose, look, there has to be consultation, so you have to have the meetings. But what I can honestly say is that as I look back over the meetings and ask myself what came out of them, it's very little, you know, and we put a lot in. If we're asked to go to speak to the minister, we don't go casually, you know, we prepare our statements and our arguments and whatever. And you really would like to get a sense that, having made that effort, that something it has come out of it. And we just honestly don't have that sense so far.
Yeah, I can understand that frustration, and I understand that you can't say it, but I would certainly say it. It just feels to me like, you know, all of this consultation, and I know huge amounts of work, because I've seen it in so many different sports, are going into putting plans in place, protocols in place, massive money being spent on sanitization and different pods, setups and everything else, and it's all like, you know, just forget it, lockdown. So it's very frustrating. And then I suppose there's a massive knock-on effect to this then as well, Bernard, in terms of the international element of the game, where we do compete very well. You know, we've got great international basketball teams, but is there a big fear that we're going to be getting left behind now by other nations?
Well, certainly, you know, that is one of the fears. I mean, even if at this stage, even if the championships go ahead during the summer at the various age levels, you know, we know that our peers around Europe have been in international camps and have been having weekend camps. Some of them have been having week-long, and we've been doing absolutely nothing. And you know, as a former elite athlete yourself, you can't just be doing nothing on Friday and then on the Saturday go into international or high-level competition. You know, there has to be a preparation period. So we're already behind all our peers. And if we host the European Championships for Men in Limerick, we'll have seven nations coming over to play us, and we know that they're all better prepared, even at this stage, than we are. But, you know, we still want the championships to go ahead. And, yeah, I think the international thing at underage level is a really sad thing, and it's nobody's fault. But, you know, our under-16s and our under-18s from last year, and possibly now for this year, are not going to get their international caps, and that's really sad because, you know, once you go over the age, you can't go backwards. So those international caps and activity are just all completely lost. Yeah. So it really is a bit of a downer. And all we're looking here for is logic and fairness, really. You know, I mean, what is the logic of the schools being open with 30 kids in a classroom for 6 hours, and yet 15 young basketballers cannot train together for an hour or an hour and a half? You know, where is the logic in that? Yeah. And I think it just, they need to look afresh on the domestic facts, and they need to take in the facts across Europe as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think maybe it's just time for all sport to come together. I know Sport Ireland is the representative, but I mean, every single sport will be making the exact same appeal as you're making. Where is the logic? What is the point? If the kids are all in the classrooms together and everything else on a daily basis, how come they can't go outside those same kids and play together and play sport together.
Yeah.
So it might be a case of all sport rather than individual sports going together. And I know Sport Ireland have been making appeals, but it just seems to be falling on deaf ears continuously, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we have had a run at that a couple of times because it's not just myself that's meeting the minister next Friday. It is the CEOs of various NGBs, and this will be our third meeting. Yeah. But sometimes I find at those meetings, people, I don't know whether I'm just a big mouth, Reggie, or whatever, you know, people don't talk up, you know, when they get in the room with influential. Some people don't anyway, you know.
Well, I can understand and I can sympathise with you because that is often the case. So it's probably that they're afraid that if they stick their head above the parapet, then they'll get their funding cut. And
correct.
That's always the threat that these organisations have.
Yeah.
And it is a big worry. Bernard, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really do wish you the very best of luck next week with your meeting with Jack Chambers, the Minister. I hope it goes well. And hopefully, we, for everybody's sake, we can see sport getting back to a little bit of normality soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Reggie. I hope to see you out in the arenas soon.
Absolutely. I've been out there a few times. A wonderful spot. Okay, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Bernard. All the best. That's Bernard O'Byrne there, CEO of Basketball Ireland, giving us his thoughts on things that are happening at the moment around that sport. And it is tough, no question about it. And I think everybody would love to see sport coming back to some sort of normality, but it's just so difficult at the moment, it really is, to try and get someone to make a decision. Time for horse racing now. Delighted to be joined on the line by Dave Weldon. Good morning, Dave.
Morning, Reg. How's things?
Very good, thank you. Very good. Beautiful spring day out there and looking outside the window. So it's a great day for racing. And good news as well, I suppose, for racing. RTE announced a big record-breaking deal they're going to be doing the next 3 years. So there's going to be loads of televised racing.
Yeah, next 3 years and loads of more free-to-air races, which is all good news. TG4 have done a great job recently on the Sundays, and now RTE are stepping up their game, and their coverage is only getting better year on year. The likes of Ruby, Jane Mangan, Katie Walsh has signed there as well, and a few other lads be dropping by, with Hugh Cal hosting. So it's only getting better, the coverage getting better, HD and everything lined up into one. It's going to be great.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. And I suppose in this current climate, the more televised sport we're getting and the more that we can see this stuff, the better. So 31 days in 2021 and 32 days in 2022 and 2023. So there's loads of horse racing to get a good look at. Okay, it's a huge weekend this weekend, obviously, with the Fairy House Easter Festival taking place and the Grand National on Monday. I suppose the big news from that was that Tiger Roll was not going to be in it.
Yeah, I think it was 50-50 whether you'd go or not, and they kind of talked about running them in Ireland, but the O'Leary's have decided that they want the English handicapper to see him, so they're going to run them in the Betfred Bowl next week.
That was a bit of the shock of it, wasn't it, that it wasn't going to be the actual Grand National?
Yeah, so they took him out because they weren't happy with the weight he was given, so he's given a rating of 166 in England, and the argument the O'Leary's have is that he's been running against cross-country horses and handicappers. He hasn't been running in grade ones, which that rating suggests he should be running in. So they're kind of saying, well, look, he's going to run in this race now. It's a grade one against the top stayers in England. He'll probably get beaten half the track. It would be great now if he won, and the O'Leary's had to kind of eat their words a little bit. It would just be a bit of drama and a bit of panto for that, given that he should be going for his three in a row in the Grand National itself.
Okay. Right, so give me your picks for the festival, what you're liking the look of.
Right, well, I'll go through the National first, because it's given us the big race and it's the focal point of the weekend, on Easter Monday, as usual. Four horses in that to keep an eye on. Discordantly for Jesse Harrington and Robbie Power, he's about a 28-1 shot. He was sixth at Cheltenham last time. Big field of suit, and hopefully he's getting a nice rhythm and go around and go well. Espinito Bella for Mark Bolger and Barry Connell. He's got a 16-1 chance. He's a novice this year. He's in good form with Coco Beach, who's one of the favourites for the race, and he's got a 16-1 chance. Off you go for Jason McManus and R.P. Burns. He's again about a 16-1 chance. He won at Leopardstown at the Dublin Racing Festival, a big handicap chase there. The fifth and sixth have won since from that race, and the fourth ran well at the festival and is going to the Aintree Grand National, so he'll have a great chance as well. And then at 9-1, kind of towards the top of the market, Run Wild Fred, second in Tiesti's back at the start of this year, and he'll be banged there. But in fairness, Reg, the favourite is latest exhibition for Paul Nolan and Brian Cooper. He's rated 153. He's 7-1 at the moment. It's going to take a good horse to beat him, because he is a potential grade one animal. He was supposed to run in the 3 mile festival chase at Cheltenham. He dodged that to come here, and take advantage of his mark. So I think he could might only play for second place, but backing a favourite in the National is not really my style. So
no.
taking a chance on a couple there, but latest exhibition will be hard to beat. And if he gets round with a clear round, he'll take a bit of stopping.
Yeah, I think it's madness backing the favourite, the Grand National, because it's just too much potluck of what can
happen. Too much go wrong, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can fall in front of you and bump you out of the way or whatever. Like, you know, you need a lot of luck to win a 30-run field.
Okay, well, plenty for people to look at there in the National. No doubt you can add those to your sweeps, anyone that's interested. Are you giving me a lucky 15 from today, or are we going to go across the festival?
I'll give you a lucky 15 for Saturday, and I'll give you a couple for tomorrow first. So with the 250, it's the Pacquiao novice hurdle there. It's a grade two. The Devil's Coachman is progressive for Noel Mead. Two wins from his last two starts. He's got a 7-2 chance for the 250. Atlantic Ferry in the 320. He's got a 9-2 chance for Henry de Bromhead and Rachel Blackmore in the mare's grade one. Now, she could have gone to Cheltenham, this mare, Atlantic Ferry. Skipped it to come here, which is something Henry's done before to success. Won in a very good time at Navan the last time, and I think she's here to take a bit of stoppage. She's probably my best bet of the weekend. Mm-hmm. Atlantic Ferry in the 320 on Sunday, and then in the 5 o'clock, an outsider in the grade one Underwriting Exchange Gold Cup, grade one for novices. Athenian Falange is 5-4 favourite. I don't like that horse at all. He's a bit quirky and a bit of a mad lad, so I'm going to take him on. And Scarlet and Dove for Joseph O'Brien and Giggins down is about 10-1 chance in the 5 o'clock on Sunday, and I think he'll take a bit of stopping each way. So that's kind of Sunday. Monday's decks are only out in the next half an hour or so, so I haven't had a proper chance to look at them. Okay. I'll tweet out some selections on Sunday evening probably for that. And then today, look, Shadeen for today, two from Fairy House and two from Cork. There's good flat racing on. Fairies, the festival's on this weekend as well. That's on TV, on TG4 this weekend, and Racing TV as well, of course. We're starting at 3:30 today on Eagle's Wings, 14-1 for Tommy Hyde and Harry Swan, who's claiming 7. The only concern with this lad is really the depth and trip. He's never run a 3 miles before on the rules. Came second in the point-to-point over 3 miles, but he's been very progressive this year. And on breeding, he should stay the trip. I think he's got a massive chance in a very competitive final at 14-1. Then in the 4:40, Sneezy Foster and Jamie Codd team up with a horse called Party Central, who's 2-1 favourite. Second in a grade two last time behind Willie Mullins' mare, Grangey. And I think she'll go one better here. Very good horse. Field isn't as strong as the last day. It's a dropping class for her, and I think she'll take a bit of stopping. Then in the 255, it could be 255, 235, Reds again. My handwriting's gone to pot.
Okay.
Dust Town Baba for Willie McCreary and Billy Lee. He's a 9-4 chance in the six furlong list race there. Six furlongs, won his last two races, and beat most of the opposition he's facing again today. The only concern is a couple of them are race fit, and this lad hasn't had a run this season, but I don't think Billy Lee would have chose him over a couple of over the stables with a runner if they didn't think he was fit and ready to go. So he's a good chance there at 9-4. And then finally, Moran in the 4:55 for Johnny Murta. He's an 11-4 chance. He was 8 in the Irish Lincoln last week, 2 weeks ago, sorry, and the step up and triple suit, and he'll take a bit of stopping. He's a good horse to follow this season.
In the 2:55, what was it, something Baba?
Lost Town Baba.
Okay, great. Just so I have a clear, because I couldn't quite hear you on the line there. Okay, that's great. I'll have a look at those. Are there many travelling for Monday or the weekend? How's it been faring out that way?
In terms of English horses coming over?
Yeah,
or,
exactly. Coming over,
I don't need any English horses in it, Reg.
Really?
To be honest. Yeah. Now, in fairness, Aintree, the way it falls this year, like the Irish National is always funny because of how it falls on Easter. So it could be directly before Aintree, or it could be a couple of weeks after, or it could be a couple of weeks between. Because Cheltenham was late this year and Easter is early enough, and then Aintree's the week after, it's not going to suit the English trainers to come over. They'd rather target their own means. And surely wouldn't have a chance anyway, Reg.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no doubt about the way things have gone at the moment. 23-5 horse in Cheltenham. Yeah. There's not much point in them coming over. What other news is there from during the week? I see there's one a story there about Aidan McDonald. The jockey's in critical condition.
Yeah, he had a bad fall at Hexham on Thursday, I think it was. He was air ambulance to James Cook Hospital there in Middlesbrough. So I think he's taking the corner now. He's conscious and all that now. So. Hope, please God, he's all right. But it was touch and go there for a while. He took a really bad fall. And then the other news, there was a bit of controversy around a racehorse owners group They've kind of bought, they bought back with a flow out of Henry de Bromhead's run, the Grand National. They bought a couple of other horses and they're selling what are called micro shares. So you pay £80 and you get 0.02% of a share of a horse. You get no financial reward from owning that portion of the horse. All you get is a welcome pack and a pen and all that kind of stuff. And the feeling of owning a horse and having a runner on the big day. So they're targeting horses who are going to be aimed at Cheltenham festivals, the Galway races, that kind of stuff. So there's going to be thousands of owners with you, but you'll have a stay in the races. And the furor is really the management fee that the people who are running this are going to be taking, and it's kind of pushed by all the big, by Racing Post, by Ed Chamberlain, by ITV, by Racing TV and all this kind of stuff. So the few people, the kind of smaller syndicate owners are saying, here, hang on a minute, this isn't right. You're fleecing lads here. So there might be some backlash to that in the coming weeks.
Well, it sounds like there should be. It doesn't sound like it's never seemed to me. Ponzi comes to mind. Okay. All right, Dave. As always, great chatting to you and looking forward to that now, the Grand National on Monday. Always a great day for the old sweep with the kids and pick a name out of the hat. So we'll enjoy that and it should be a great day. You enjoy it too. Have a good weekend. Have a good Easter.
Cheers, Brad. Same to you.
A lot. That's Dave Weldon there of the Racing Hour podcast, giving his thoughts on all of the racing for this weekend. Time to turn our attention to rugby now. Apologies, I think I said it was Rory O'Connor that we had this morning. It is, of course, Will Slattery that we have this morning. Good morning, Will. How are you?
Hi, Reggie. How are you?
Good, thanks. Very good. It's been kind of an interesting 24 hours, is the way I'll describe it, in rugby. No question about it. The Leinster match cancelled last minute, but very strange the way it was all left to unfold, wasn't it?
Very, very strange. And I'm kind of trying to put my thoughts together on what I feel about it. Like, ultimately, I don't really understand why, if a player tested positive on the Wednesday and they knew it then, why they were allowed to come over and why we only found out the game was being cancelled a short time before kickoff. But then, so that's obviously maybe an EPCR issue, an organisation issue. But then when you get to kind of the recrimination and the reaction from Toulon, and, you know, for me, the interesting thing, I feel like, you know, when there's so many cases coming out of French clubs and you see the French national team and the way they behave during the Six Nations, I don't feel like they deserve the benefit of the doubt. Like, the French president, the Toulon president, you know, as the French club presidents love to do, straight into the media afterwards, it's a disgrace, it's a scandal, it's an absolute travesty. Like, spare me the amateur dramatics, please, for a second, Mr. President. Like, your clubs and your national team have really big questions to answer about your COVID protocols. From an Irish perspective, there's been one game where you might point the finger, and that ultimately the Leinster Munster game turned out to be because of false positives. So my overwhelming feeling was just of you know, massive disappointment that the game didn't go ahead. But then I saw Sergio Parise kind of calling on French clubs to, I think, maybe boycott the weekend is what it sounded like on social media. I'm just thinking, give me a break. Like, you guys wanted to play this game with a potential COVID case, you know, more COVID cases. We don't know yet. You wanted to play this game. They were offered a chance to play it on Sunday, and then the president, that was a sporting impossibility. Like, give me a break. I'm just very, very annoyed with how it's unfolded. Organisationally, we probably should have known about this earlier in the week. But then from a rugby perspective, I really feel like Toulon should wind their neck in a little bit and understand that they are the ones who ultimately caused it.
Yeah, I think the whole president calling and Parise and all that, that's all just smokescreen rubbish. The usual story that you get from France, trying to just cover them, you know, themselves about it. They're at fault. I mean, that's the bottom line. But I suppose the big question about this is, and, you know, the one that I'd be more concerned about than anything else is, why did the EPRC allow them to come? I mean, why wasn't this dealt with before they even set foot in the country? I mean, it makes no sense. Why would you allow them to travel on Wednesday only to wait until the last hour to cancel the game? Surely the medical checks, apart from everything else, you shouldn't be bringing people with the potential of infections into the country. You know, I don't understand why they...
Like, as I understand it, or kind of a piece that I got yesterday from it, was that Toulon were claiming that it was one guy with COVID and that there was no other close contacts. And apparently yesterday there was some sort of analysis during their training session, it was determined that the rest of the front row were close contacts and ruled out. Now, why this couldn't have been done earlier in the week? Perhaps there was a breakdown in communication between the two parties. I'm 100% with you. I don't understand how we're waiting until noon on Friday when there was a positive case on the Wednesday, and the competing statements don't seem to really address the reason. To be fair, so Toulon might have a point on that case. I concede, like, why are they over in Dublin in the first place? The EPCR are claiming that, you know, we can't stop a team from travelling, but that sounds like a bit of a cop-out to me. I don't really understand the point you raised there. Why are we only getting this news just before kickoff or shortly before kickoff? This needs to have been dealt with earlier in the week to see if a compromise could have been reached. I think the Toronto president is claiming he's only being told on a Friday afternoon that you can play on a Sunday if you find six new front rows. If it's on a Wednesday, perhaps that's a feasible outcome, but it didn't turn out that way.
That makes no sense anyway, because the six front rows would have been on the plane, on the bus, on the everything else with all the rest of the players that would have come over anyway. So they're now close contacts of the entire rest of the squad. So that makes no sense either. So
yeah, I'm not 100% sure whether the rest of the front rows had travelled over in the end. I need to double check that. I could be wrong on that, but my understanding was that they had. I need to double check that. But yeah, I agree with you. There's a lot of questions that.
Well, I don't agree with the EPCR washing their hands of it and blaming, the other thing. Either we can't stop people traveling. That's not true. They're the organisers of this event. They're the ones responsible for how all of the protocols are carried out. They should have been the ones that were making the communication to Toulon and saying to them, no, you need to stay put until we get testers in, get everybody checked. When we're 100% clear that everybody is negative and they're safe, you can then travel. That's like... anyone could have worked that out, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And, like, that's the frustrating thing is that, you know, they've done their tests now. They were all negative. They got tested when they got to Dublin. They were all negative.
Yeah.
But the issue is that, you know, this can take a couple of days to manifest itself. If the game was played on a Sunday even, and then Leinster, say, were to win, then Leinster maybe get a positive off the back of that, then that's a knock-on effect. It's a whole can of worms.
Yeah.
It should have been nipped in the bud earlier, the noon on the Friday, with the game a few hours away.
You see, Rory was putting in the paper earlier, or tweeted out earlier, that if Leinster win this year, there should be an asterisk beside their name instead of a star. Does this undermine the competition this year, do you think?
Well, like, you can't say anything but yes, in the sense that the pool stages were truncated, and now you have a knockout stage, walkover. I guess it depends who wins it, in a way, you know. Like, if Leinster go to Exeter and then play Racing and then play, you know, another big gun and win, like, I think we will forget ultimately about the Toulon chaos and we'll remember a COVID championship. But I don't know. I wouldn't go as far as Rory, to be honest. Obviously, if there's more cancellations in the knockout stage, it becomes a bit of a piss take. But the group stages has become a bit predictable anyway. Like, it probably wasn't any harm in fast-forwarding that part. And I think we've actually stumbled upon maybe a new format going forward with the four knockout rounds. See the excitement and the buzz around this weekend of the additional knockout round and plotting the various permutations. I wouldn't go as far as to say an asterisk if Leinster were going to go on and win it, but it definitely, the whole tournament, it's a COVID year. Concessions are being made across the board. Leinster and Munster played in the final last weekend. Ordinarily, there would have been semi-finals. Concessions have to be made. Now, if there's another cancellation in the knockout stages, it gets a bit faster. But for the moment, I wouldn't go as far as Rory did, but that's an opinion people do have.
Yeah, okay. Well, the other big game that we're all really looking forward to this weekend, of course, is the Munster against Toulouse game, which is on today at 3:00. Lots of talk around Munster after a pretty poor performance against Leinster last week. They never really came to town at all, and they were put away. Leinster, another title under their belt. Munster, another year without anything. Huge pressure on them coming in to this European competition. And they're without Peter O'Mahony now as well because of injury. And, I looked at that Toulouse team that's gone down to Thome, and I know people are saying, the French don't travel, they don't do this, that and the other. I can't see Munster beating them, to be honest with you, if I'm perfectly honest. That just looks like too good of a Toulouse team for me.
Yeah, no, it's a really strong team, and you could argue that they have the two best players in the tournament in Antoine Dupont and Cheslin Colby, and when they click, they are almost impossible to stop. Like, from my perspective, and it's funny, Niall Scanlon kind of articulated it during the week that he was like, we're going to come out swinging, like, we're going to come out fire. And, like, if Munster don't come out with a response today after what happened last weekend, I really feel like it's the end of the line for this team. In the sense, they are building something, but at the same time, I don't think they're going in the... If they can't muster a response today, you really have to question the direction they're going in. You could potentially give them a little bit of, not a pass, but like Leinster have had it over them. I don't know if it's almost become a mental thing as well as a structural thing and an on-field rugby issue. I think they will get up for today, and I actually would give them a chance. But Toulouse are missing some important players in that team, and it's a funny one. Like if Munster do go out and play really well today and win, it almost raises more questions than answers. And then you're thinking, well, where was this last week? You had a chance to win a trophy, your biggest rivals, and you didn't even fire a shot. You didn't even get close to them. You didn't even put up any fight. That's why I'm so intrigued about today. It'll answer questions about the direction the team is going in. It will raise questions about why they couldn't deliver it last week. And even if they do win, they're facing into a very foreboding task the following week. I think it's set up absolutely perfectly. The only thing we're missing is a full house at Tomlin Park, which probably could have been the decider had it been there. Toulouse went to Ulster early in the season and only won narrowly. They needed a couple of moments of magic from DuPont, from Colby to get over the line. I think they're a really strong team, but I don't think they're as good as Leinster when they're humming like they were last weekend. And if Munster play well, I think they can beat them.
Yeah, well, look, there's always the possibility. It's just on current form, I haven't been convinced that Munster are in the right place at the moment. They don't. Like, I watched that game twice last week just purely because I was so intrigued to see, you know, how were Leinster able to stifle them so much? What did they do? And the reality of it is, if I'm perfectly honest, is I just didn't see Munster offer anything. There didn't seem to be any threat around the base. Didn't seem to be any threat off their back line. You know, I just couldn't find. And I'm saying, how do you change that within a week against a team of the quality of Toulouse, albeit that you're at home in Thomond Park? But you can't keep relying on Thomond Park for it. And you can't keep relying on the French being poor travellers either. You know, you got to show us something else that indicates that. Now, look, I hope they do beat them. There's no question about that. I do want them to beat them. But I'm struggling to find where it's going to come from.
Well, my big thing watching the match last weekend, and what I could not get over for the life of me, was in my mind, this was teed up to be Munster's Croke Park moment. You know, when Leinster finally got the monkey off the back, it was a great performance on the pitch, but it was a mentality. There was an aggressiveness. There was a narkiness. There was a sense amongst all the players, 1-15 that day in Croke Park, that they were not going to take it anymore. That they were not going to be beaten again by Munster. They were not going to be beaten in the manner in which they had been beaten previously, which was fairly comprehensive defeats. It was almost a question of their internal guts, almost.
Well, for me, Will, it was the 2006 one that I was involved in, where they came up and bet us hard in Lansdowne Road. You know, that was what I thought this was going to be, that they were going to go up and make a mark. And an awful lot of people were talking it up that way and saying they were going to make a mark.
And what stuck out to me was then, okay, you have the first half then. Leinster are going great guns, but they're butchering chance after chance. Yeah. Munster are hanging on. How does that not give the team a great boost? Then you get a penalty just before halftime. You go in at 6-0. You should be 26 down.
Exactly.
They should have been jumping out of the changing room in the second half. They should have been like, we actually fought. Because, to be fair to them, they probably hadn't got the rub of the green in some of these games over the last year or so against Leinster. They got it in that first half. Leinster butchered those chances. And yet, when the second half started, Leinster marched straight down the field and finally got their try. That was what was almost more galling to me, was that you get into the changing room, you regroup with your coaching staff, your highly paid coaching staff, you're in the game, you're 6-0, and then you're even worse in the second half. You don't score in the second half. The third game in a row against Leinster, where Munster have not scored a point in the second half. Like, that's maddening. And I suppose I'm kind of talking myself out of my pick again today against Toulouse, but I just feel like there has to be a response.
Well, that's it. I mean, it is... Whenever I talk about Munster, people say I'm anti them and I'm overly dramatic, but I'm not. It's actually make or break time for this coaching staff, in my opinion, to make it happen, because they've failed to fire properly for the last number of seasons. And if they go out today at this stage of the competition with another damn squib of a season, you know, you have to question how much longer that can be accepted. Highly paid, as you said.
Yeah, no, definitely. And just one point you raised there, like you said, you're a Leinster guy, so people are like automatically write it off. That's something that really like bugs me. And I think it's a problem. Like, Munster fans, like, you know, when Luke Bristram always say something on the podcast, they're like, oh, it's only a Leinster guy. That's why I was delighted to see Keane Tracy, a Limerick man in the Irish Independent this week, write a really, I thought, fair analysis of where Munster are at the moment. Like, at least he's one of their own, so they can't just say it's begrudgery from, up the road in Dublin. But to your point about the coaching staff, like, it's really stark when you see the way Munster are playing and the results they're not getting. And then you see someone like Ronan O'Gara, last night. I know they were playing a weak Gloucester team, but they were playing really good rugby. He spoke really intelligently about the game afterwards. We see him in the media all the time. He talks so well. He's so involved still with Irish rugby. The question I'd have if I was a Munster fan was, this guy is Mr. Munster. He's built a great CV at some of the greatest clubs in the world. He's won trophies everywhere he's gone. They're primed to do well this year as well. Why isn't heaven and earth being moved to get him in? And it was an interesting line he had in his Irish Examiner column on Friday, where he said, basically said, I might never coach Munster, or, you know, I'm not involved at the moment. As in, he was kind of distancing himself, and you'd have to wonder why he'd be saying that. Is he not have? Does he think maybe Leinster are too good? Does he think, I don't think I could work under these current constraints? I just thought it was a very curious line from a man we would have all presumed would love the job, but it seems that even he at the moment, for reasons he didn't really articulate in the column, he's maybe having, not second thoughts, but he doesn't maybe want to rush into that job just now, which is, it kind of says a lot about where Munster are at the moment.
Well, it very much does. I read that article. I was intrigued exactly the same way. I was kind of saying to myself, it doesn't feel like, A, he's been approached, or it's even been on the table,
yeah.
And B, that he really wants it, you know, because Rog is like an amazing coach, in my opinion. I actually see Rog as going towards the Irish job. That's how far I rate him, along with Paul O'Connell. I mean, the difference O'Connell has made since he's come into that Irish setup is phenomenal. So I'd have no problem with the two of them taking up the reins running the Irish situation, because I think it would be a brilliant setup. But failing that, I cannot work out for the life of me how that isn't been targeted for Munster, because it's a no-brainer in my mind, an absolute no-brainer. They're the heart and soul of what Munster are all about. They bring it back to being what it's supposed to be about, and make the players understand what that means to put on that jersey. It's worked in Leinster with Leo and other people that are involved in there. And I just don't, it confuses me why it hasn't happened. And maybe it's Ronan. Maybe he just, like you said, maybe he doesn't want the job yet.
Yeah, no, it's a funny one, because as you say, it's the obvious question. He's Mr. Munster, but it's not putting him in for the sake of it. He has the CV to back it up.
Yeah.
He won a top 14, which he actually explained in great detail during the week on Off the Ball. I thought it was a massive insight. In that top 14 final against Toulon, Racing had their scrum half sent off after, you know, 20 minutes. That should be game over. But he talked through the thought process amongst the coaching staff, how they didn't even bring on a nine. They went with their winger. It was a really interesting insight into a top-class coach.
Clever.
This guy, he embodies Munster. Munster are crying out for someone like him. Why isn't it? Yeah, as you say, it didn't sound like there's even been an approach. What I thought was a bit unusual was a couple of years ago, I think Van Graan was like halfway through or three-quarters of the way through his first season with a year left on his deal, and they gave him a two-year extension. Mm. I was like, well, why is he getting 2 years extension when he has a year left on his deal? So at the moment, he has another year on his current contract. I don't think, I think he'll stay no matter, you know, even if they lose it to lose, I don't think he'll be departing. And, you know, the O'Gara one is a bit of a head scratcher. I think he maybe has his eyes, as you say, maybe going to the Ireland job after in 2023. Yeah. He has a good gig in La Rochelle. They're fighting on two fronts this year. Does he really want to go now to Munster when they're in a position where Leinster are really dominant and it might be very difficult to pick them up? Possibly not. Maybe that's his consideration. I don't know. It's a very interesting conversation, though.
Yeah, it may possibly be that he doesn't want it. Yeah, it could be the case. The other thing, and Donal Callum was talking about this during the week, is the fact that there they go again, getting another South African in, Jason Jenkins being brought in to Munster. You can't ignore the South African connections that are there because of so many South African players being brought into the setup. But as Donica says, there should be more homegrown talent coming into that squad. It seems to be losing its whole what made Munster Munster, you know?
I agree completely. And again, it was great to see Donegal O'Callaghan putting his name on it in the media, because it's really easy, again, for someone like Luke Fitzgerald, who's been kind of going on about this a lot. And then again, it's, you know, he just doesn't like overseas players. He doesn't like Munster. But it's great to see Donegal O'Callaghan articulating a point that I think everyone feels. Like, even if you're not from Munster, the glory days of Munster were built on those homegrown guys. And obviously, it's very important to supplement that with outside talent. But like, Doug Howlett, Scott Farley, Rocky Elsa, these are guys who have played in World Cup finals, who are at the peak of the international game. Getting Jason Jenkins in, who, I'm not going to lie, I haven't seen the guy play, so he might be the best second row in the world, but he's 25, he's from the Blue Bulls, he's playing in Japan, he's been capped once for South Africa, he's on a one-year deal.
this doesn't scream I'm bringing in a veteran international to help the next generation. This feels like I have a one-year mercenary contract to improve the team in the short term. And when you have guys like Thomas O'Hearn, who is Munster's Ryan Baird in the sense that they were both 22nd rows in around the same time and both showed huge potential. Ryan Baird has been backed, and look at how well he's playing. Thomas O'Hearn got man of the match in one of his first, you know, he started a few games against Benetton about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And now he's been, now we're being told he'll be playing in the back row, Jenkins. But even then, they have guys like Jack O'Sullivan in the back row. You know, guys like Alex Pendlin, a little bit younger, in the back row. Like, if I was one of those guys, I would honestly be like, what's going on here? Like, it's a one-year deal for a Springbok mercenary, whereas this is actually the best, ironically, generation of Munster players they've had, probably since those glory years. And it doesn't feel like they're getting the support and the backing that they actually deserve.
I know. Yeah, it's a strange one. There's no question about it. It doesn't do a whole lot for Irish rugby either. As it goes forward, you know. But anyway, I suppose that's what's going to happen. If there's going to be that connection with foreign coaches and to South Africa, they're just going to try and plug gaps and make it all about results. You know, make it all about results. But anyway, a tough one today for them. No question about it. You're going to go with Munster. You think they can still get it done? I think they're up against it, but I hope they do get it done. But I think it's a real. The most amazing thing about this game, and I can't wait for it, is. It's absolutely so much more than the result. It's completely about the psychology around the game, how they react, what this will tell us about the Munster squad, about the coaching staff, and about the players. I think that's the most intriguing thing about it, because they're up against it today, and it's their reaction that I'm most intrigued to see.
Big time, yeah. It's a perfect tonic for the disappointment of missing that Leinster Toulon game last night. I think everyone was circling the Munster one on the calendar for the big game of the weekend. And as you say, it's massive. And it's funny, we're obviously coming at it from an Irish perspective, but from a Toulouse perspective as well. Like, they haven't won a European Cup since 2010. They've invested heavily. They have an unbelievable squad. They'll be under pressure as well to deliver. It's not just a one-way street in terms of the pressure. Like, if Toulouse go out at this stage to a team that they would expect to beat, given the calibre and finances that they have in their squad, like, they'll be getting a rough ride, no doubt, from the French media. I think it's set up massively for Munster. And the funny thing is, you know, I feel bad for them in the sense that they do win today, as good as it is, they might have to go to Claremont next week and beat them again away from home, just like they did earlier in the season. So, no rest for the wicked.
The only disappointment is there'll be no crowd there to roar it on. Okay. Mm. Will, as always, great chatting to you. Thanks so much for that, and we'll catch you up again next week.
Thanks, Reggie.
Cheers. That's Will Slattery there giving us all of his thoughts, and great thoughts they are too, on the Munster-Toulouse game that takes place a little bit later on today. Okay, it's time to return our attention to GAA now, and it was announced during the week that 9 of the Dublin players, a big story on the Irish Independent, were found to be training against all regulations during the week, and it's been the talking point right across social media, the media, and everything. All week long, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Declan Drake to talk about it now. Morning, Declan, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Reg. How are you?
Good, thanks. Good indeed. Like everybody was busy looking at this during the week and trying to work out in my own head what was going on. I got a text in just there from somebody just to say I'm a taxi driver, and all this going on about the 9 Dublin team members. I drove the canal Thursday and Friday, upwards of 800 people drinking in groups of 20 to 30, no police anywhere. And I think there was a lot of that, you know, being said by a lot of people during the week from scenes that we've seen in public parks. But also, equally so, there were just as many people saying this isn't acceptable. These guys are members of a sporting organisation that's looked up to by thousands, and they shouldn't be doing this type of thing. What's your initial reaction to it and your own view on it, Declan?
Very disappointed, first of all, Reg, that it happened. Very sad that it happened, and it shouldn't have happened. These are a high-profile group of individuals. They're members of the All-Ireland Champions, the greatest team in the history of the game. Less than 24 hours after a clear pathway is announced towards the return to collective inter-county training, this event happens. It was completely wrong. It was ill-advised by the people that took part in it, and the sanction of the suspension, 12-week suspension of Desi Farrell, I would have to give credit, I think, in this case, to the Dublin County Board, Reg, for the swiftness of their action, the investigation that they took place surrounding this and the sanction, which happens, of course, to be the same level of sanction as two other inter-county managers had imposed on them by Croke Park after similar breaches of the training ban just after Christmas. But unlike the other two county boards, the Dublin County Board have taken the decisive action. Obviously, they've been clearly embarrassed by this. They knew nothing about it. The GAA has been severely embarrassed by this and put in a very difficult position.
Well, Declan, you're giving credit there to the county board for taking fast action. But can you tell us more around, what their decision was based upon? Because here's what I'm wondering. A lot of people wondering, is this a case of getting Desi to fall on his sword for 12 weeks? What sanctions have been taken against the nine players and, you know, if any?
Well, none, as I was indicated in the statement. The only reference to the players was the apology that was issued on their behalf to the general GAA public and the public in general as well. Desi Farrell is the figurehead of the Dublin team. He's the manager of the Dublin team. If he sanctioned it, he shouldn't have sanctioned it. If he didn't know about it, why didn't he know about it? So that's.
But Declan, can you see how that would be confusing for a lot of our listeners? Because, you know, we've got so many Dublin supporters here who are backing the fact that, you know, they're saying, what harm, the lads are out playing football, they're this, they're that, the other and everything else. I'm the same. I'm saying I don't disagree with outdoor sport and everything else. I think it should be allowed, but it isn't. When you say that, there's nothing happening to these nine players, that almost says, well, then they were directed to do this by Desi. Has there been any transparency about that, where the direction came from around this training session? Who organised it? Surely people need to know that.
They do, absolutely. And while there has been no action taken against the players just yet, what the GAA might do after their investigation, Reg, remains to be seen. Will they impose suspensions on the players who were identified as having been present at that? We all guess the level of frustration that's out there in the public at the moment, from the amateur golfer who has had his Sunday morning game with his mates taken away from him, the ladies who meet for tennis on a Thursday night, or whatever the case might be, right? We all understand the frustration surrounding that, right? But there was a clear pathway here for just two more weeks to hold on for this. Go back, collect the training, four-week lead-in, start perhaps National League in the middle of May. And this has been kicked back in people's faces. And quite frankly, although I do understand the frustration, I get all that, it's simply just not acceptable. And the fact that this is the third confirmed case, right, the third confirmed case of this, after Down and after Cork post-Christmas, it is wrong. People might say it's happening in other counties around the country as well. Perhaps it is. We have no real evidence to support that argument at the moment. But I reiterate the point again. The pathway was there less than 24 hours beforehand, and they went out and they just breached it, which is completely wrong.
Yeah, and I mean, it must be an absolute nightmare for the GAA organisers, because let's face it, GAA had been getting a bad rap anyway for earlier in the lockdown, when maybe there was sort of club games going on and championships and videos and images of trophies being paraded through villages and being blamed as super spreader events and all this kind of stuff. So like, it really needed to keep its head down and just do things right. So that's why I suppose I would be confused and not sure that if it's the right message, that, you know, it's only Desi is the one that's taking the blame on this. And some people are saying, so what difference does it make? It's only 12 weeks and there's nothing really on at the moment anyway.
Well, I did actually attempt to contact the county board on Thursday afternoon after their statement had been issued. And the short response that I got to the inquiry was, we refer to our statements. Mm. That's the response that I got to the query. As regards what the actual GAA itself in Croke Park will do, the precedent has been in the past a 12-week suspension for the two managers, although the Down manager, I believe, had it downgraded to 8 weeks upon appeal, right? Mm. So are they going to impose a double sanction on Desi Farrell? That's the first question. The second question is what action they take, if any, against the players that were involved in this. Then there was the issue of a National League game, home National League game, being forfeited, right, as had been the case in Cork. Now, my understanding, and of course this hasn't been confirmed just yet because we don't know the new structure of the National League in the master fixture list which we await. My understanding from during the week is that Dublin would have games against Roscommon and against Kerry, which would be both away from home, right? Which wouldn't affect anything, obviously. Mm. But a home game against Galway in Dublin, which, you know, if it follows through, would be switched then to a neutral venue. The other question is then, do the county boards suffer a financial penalty because of this as well? It's one very, very sorry mess, and it's one that everybody in Dublin GAA and the GAA in general, Reg, can simply do without at the moment. The other thing is, how did this come out? How did this come out? How did a national newspaper conveniently show up at whatever time it was on Wednesday morning to take these photographs? That's another issue as well, you know.
Always come out. That's the stupidity of organising something. In the world that we live in now, you cannot get away with things like that. It's a high-profile players, you know, and ordinary people can't get away with it, you know, and it's, people are, you know, the paper never refused ink. People are dying for things to write about, and you're putting yourself in a position where, you know, what did you think was going to happen? You know, what did you actually think was going to happen? That you're going to get away with it and no one was going to know about it and it wasn't going to come out?
Mm. Yeah, well, it happened on GAA grounds too. Yeah. Well, that's another issue as well. But
the return to sport? I know they're saying they'll go ahead on the 12th of April, but I mean, is it not just giving ammunition to those that want to keep everything shut down and want to make it even worse now? And are inter-county games and championships in jeopardy?
Well, it certainly doesn't help the case, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Whether they're in jeopardy or not, I don't think so. I think it would be grossly unfair on the other counties who have, as far as we understand anyway, behaved themselves over the last number of months and adhered to the restrictions that have been in place. The public is buying out for a return to inter-county action, which would probably be around the middle of May at this moment in time, because they have to allow something like 4 weeks of a lead time after collective training starts. And nobody would appreciate Dublin or anybody else if the GAA came out and decided to push that back because of this event. I don't think it personally will be affected, but it will be interesting to see what sanctions the GAA do take against the association in the county.
Yeah, and I mean, the last thing, I hate witch hunts against people and against players and all these kind of, and at the end of the day, as people say, it's not like these lads were, you know, in a shebeen having parties and, you know, all that kind of stuff, which are, they were outside kicking a football in the fresh air. And I agree with all of that. It's just, unfortunately, in the world that we're in now, as much as you might agree with it or not agree with it, we can't do that. We just can't go against the rules, because you're leaving yourself wide open to this type of debate. And it just, when so many people, like, they're, for all of the supporters that are out there that are getting behind the players and behind the management and behind everything else, whether it be in this county or any other county, equally there are a lot more out there that are outraged that they think that they can just do what they want and ignore the rules, because so many people have sacrificed so much. And I think that's the real problem. It's not about being a witch hunt. It's just, it really, really disappoints a lot of people.
I live here in Crumlin, Reg, and my house backs onto to Pierce Park in Crumlin, which is the home of Crumlin GAA.
Yeah.
Mostly, right? On a normal Saturday morning, the fields would be flooded with kids, at their camps and their training sessions and whatnot. And obviously, we haven't had that now for a number of months. And that's frustrating for the kids, and it's frustrating for the parents and the coaches and everybody that's involved. And when you see something like this happening, and as it happened in Cork and happened in Down as well, and obviously didn't get as much profile, it's really, really disappointing. But hopefully, look, we've learned the lessons from this and we can move on.
Okay. Declan, as always, great chatting to you. Really enjoyed that. And we'll chat again next week or the week after, hopefully, when things are getting a little bit better and there's more to talk about than things like this.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get back to talking about hurling and football
again.
A bit of action is right, Reg. Yeah, take care.
Thanks. You have a great Easter, Declan. Take care of yourself.
Thanks, Reg. Take care. Bye-bye. Cheers.
That's Declan Drake there, RGA correspondent, giving us all of his thoughts on that incident during the week with the nine Dublin players and Desi Farrell's suspension. Just quickly before we go to break, I want to give you the Lucky 15 again, because a few people were on texting looking for it. So, two from Fairy House, the 330 on Eagles Wings, the 440 is Party Central. They're both in Fairy House. And then we go to Cork for the 235, and it's Lustown Baba, and then Miran in the 455. So that's it. We'll get those up on social media for you as well. Time to turn our attention to football now. Delighted to be joined by Alan Cawley on the line. Morning, Alan. How are you?
Reggie, how are you? Are you okay?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Didn't get to enjoy any Leinster game last night, but through to the next round. Looking forward to the Munster one later on today. But it was an interesting week in football as well. I want to start with the international side. And, you know, it's been very tough on Stephen Kenny. But I do feel people are realising the task that he has and the difficulty that he has. And, you know, while there's a few calls for change, most people are sticking with him.
That's the thing, and that's the word, Reg, you realise him, because maybe last Saturday's game was a blessing in disguise in terms of a realisation of just where we are and just how far we've fallen in terms of the lack of development and investment that has gone into not just the international team, but Irish football in general, that feeds into the international team. And it's a reality check, Reggie, and we're at a crossroads now, probably the biggest crossroads we've ever been at in Irish football in terms of what do we put plans and structures in place now and have a serious hunger and appetite to try and improve and not just pay lip service to it, but actually put a structure and a plan in place that we're actually going to look to deliver and do deliver over the next 5 or 10 years? Or do we just plod along as we are with our head in the sand and we get to another 2 or 3 years' time and we're having these same discussions? Because these discussions and conversations have been going on for quite a while, Reggie, in terms of the last few years and people predicting or preempting where we could be or where we end up. Everything was always short-term viewing and short-term fixes in terms of maybe one tournament, and if we get through, it's great, and it papers over the cracks. But here's the realisation last week that we played Luxembourg and we got beat at home, and there's a dearth of talent in terms of, there's lots of young players and talent coming through, but they're going to take time, and Stephen deserves that time, I feel. I think he's the right man to do that. And it could be 7 or 8 games down the line, Reggie, we could be having a different conversation in terms of Stephen. But in terms of the way we're going forward with younger players and trying to play a more progressive style of football, there's plenty of other managers that can do that, not just Stephen. That's where we're at. We can't go back to the old days. And it shouldn't be a case either, I think, Reggie, of viewing it 50-50, that it's either the old days or the new days as such. There's a balance to be met with how we play football, but we have to be a bit more progressive in how we approach things and how we want to play. Because you look at all the other countries and the likes of Luxembourg and the likes of Macedonia beating Germany, they're all improving, and we're not only are we standing still, we're regressing, Reggie.
But shouldn't we also get a realisation that we're on a par with Macedonia, Luxembourg, all of these smaller nations? We get a little bit caught up on ourselves. You know, I watched the Jack Charlton documentary, and almost in a bad way for us, it's like there were amazing times, but it's given us this idea that we're on a par with the elite teams in the world when we're quite simply not.
Absolutely, Reggie. That's what I'm talking about in terms of a realization last week. There's almost an entitlement. And the worst thing you can ever be in life is self-entitled. And there's almost an entitlement out there that we think we should be just rocking up and beating Luxembourg. But anyone that knows football and knows, as you say, where what the factors that have kind of played a part in all this, anyone that knows that is real and doesn't think that we should rock up and beat Luxembourg. Obviously, you still have fans and people who maybe think that and the glory days. But the glory days were 30 years ago, Reggie. Mm. 35 years ago. And as you said, there were great times and great memories. But none of that stuff was ever built on. And the stuff that's been going on in recent times, qualifying for the odd tournament here and there, as I said to you last week, it's great for 2 or 3 weeks. But what do we take from it or learn from it or build from it or improve on?
The obvious thing, Alan, is, you know, everybody keeps talking about it. It keeps going back to it. I said it earlier in the show to Ken about rugby was really, really lucky. And I use the word lucky, that they got in at the beginning of professionalism and put in systems in place. It's great management by the RFU, and huge credit to them for that, for putting in systems and academies and grassroots development at that stage. But it was at the very beginning of professionalism. We've been left behind by the rest of the world in football. So the money that it's going to cost to try and, you know, put ourselves, to put those structures in place that you were talking about, I don't know where it's going to come from.
Yeah, but not alone that, Reggie. And I take your point about the rugby being lucky at the start, but they've still put unbelievable structures in place and what they've done and achieved going along with that.
Yeah.
And even though the football and professional era has been around football for years and years, we still have people who are in roles to deliver on these things, and the questions have to be asked to those people and the organisation and all that stuff that has gone on over the years. And it's not just bash the FEI. There's plenty of good people in the FEI and plenty of good people who have left the FEI because they felt as though they had to leave because maybe their voice wasn't being heard, or they had these plans and ideas. But as I say, we're at a crossroads now, Reggie. There is a new regime in there, you'd like to think. Now, I'm hearing mixed views in terms of still the morale in the FEI and stuff like that with people. But you'd like to think there's an appetite to try and improve and change. Because
well,
as
where
I say,
would the money come from, Al? I mean, it's such well, it has a big to come, animal of an organisation. Where does the money come to?
Well, that's where, again, you come back to the investment in terms of the government and seeing exactly what football means to people in this country. And when I'm talking about football in this country, Reggie, I'm not just talking about the international team. You go through every country in the world or in Europe or whatever. Their national league is their most important league. Our view here is that it's the Premier League is our most important league. And that can't be the case. And that's not me just sticking with my League of Ireland head on. Yeah. The National League is the biggest league we have here, and it has to be developed and invested. And we have to build some sort of an industry to try and progress things and move things forward. Because the days of the young lads going to England at 15, 16 and letting the English clubs develop the players, they're long gone, Reggie. They're long gone now. And it's much harder for young lads going across the water. Plus, you have Brexit involved in it now as well. So we have to build some sort of an industry, academy structures. To be fair to the likes of Shamrock Rovers, Bohemians, a couple of clubs are doing it properly. The clubs, I feel as though they want to do it properly, but there's a major divide in how the FEI went about implementing the national leagues and the fallout with the schoolboy structure here in the country. And that's where there has to be joined up thinking and us all singing off the same hymn sheet, Reggie. Mm. Now, that's a different argument in how you get everybody singing off the same hymn sheet, because there's a lot of egos, there's a lot of agendas, there's a lot of people feeling as though their voice is not being heard or their corner is not being looked after. But for the good of the game here, we all have to look at the highest level that is in the country and let it all filter down from there, because otherwise we're going nowhere.
Yeah, strong governance is what's needed there, and that's what we haven't had for a long time in the FAI, unfortunately. Hopefully that will change. Good result last night for Rovers, though, getting 2-1 victory over Dundalk.
Yeah, it was a great result. They actually fancied them strongly going into the game, Reggie. I was disappointed with Dundalk in their first two games. And to be fair to Dundalk, it was Rovers were dominant in the first half, and they were good value for their lead. Danny Mandrow got a great goal, but Dundalk did improve a lot in the second half, and they put Shamrock Rovers under a lot of pressure. Their goalkeeper again was brilliant, Alan Manis, yeah. And then Dundalk. So it was almost a tale of an incident happening in 2 minutes. At one end, Alan Manis pulls off a great save from Michael Duffy, and in the next attack, Shamrock Rovers went up the pitch and Dylan Watts takes a shot, and the goalkeeper makes a howler for Dundalk and lets it through his body. So Alan Manis was the difference in the second half, but I still felt as though Shamrock Rovers were worthy winners. I felt as though they were the better team overall, Reggie. Yeah. And there is question marks around Dundalk at the moment with the start that they've had, but there is positives to take from the second half performance.
Indeed there was. And a good win as well for your old club, Sligo, beating Longford 1-0.
Yeah, they've had a great start. Top of the league, Reggie. Yeah, top of the league. Yeah. No, they've had a great start, John, in fairness. And it was good. I felt as though going into the season, there was a lot of hype around them. Not too much hype, but people were hopeful and looking forward to it because of the signings they made. And thankfully, that's transpired with the start. And it's so important that you get off to a good start. That'll carry them forward so much now. Next week, they're playing Shamrock Rovers, which will be a cracker in the showgrounds. And that'll just see just where they are, because Shamrock Rovers are still the best team in the league. Albeit that I think, as I said to you at the very start of the league, I don't think they're going to run away with it by any means. It'll be competitive this year. So it'll be a good test for Sligo Rovers to see just where they're at. But they've picked up 7 points from 9, so that's a great start.
Big derby this evening as well. Bows against Pat, 6 o'clock.
I'm heading into that, Reggie, and I'm looking forward to it at Daly Mount. To be fair, it's been actually, St. Pat's have had the better start. St. Pat's have picked up 4 points out of 6. They followed up their good performance against Shamrock Rovers with a win against Drogheda last week. And Bows are the ones that are playing catch-up. I know it's only 2 games into it, but they've had a poor start. So I'd be interested to see how Bows, I haven't seen them yet live this season, so I'm looking forward to seeing them, and you'd expect a big reaction from them as well, judging by the start that they've had. It's been poor from their standard.
Apart from everything else, Alan, you'll just love being at a live game. I was lucky enough to work the Leinster game in the RDS there a couple of weeks ago, and we were the only two in the stand, myself and Liam Toland. We're the only two in the place, pretty much, bar the players. It's just a great feeling being at a live game. Really was.
Absolutely, Reggie. Yeah, it really is. I'm looking forward to that, definitely. It's a lovely, looks like it's a lovely day outside. Hopefully it's a nice evening. Daily about 6 o'clock kickoff as well. Two good teams. So, yeah, just to go to a game, Reggie.
Yes, exactly.
I'm delighted.
Get out of the house and go somewhere different. That's what it's all about. That's what, we were very fortunate. Okay, well, you enjoy that and have a wonderful Easter and mind yourself.
Brilliant. Thanks a million. You too, Reggie.
Take care. That's Alan Cawley there giving us his thoughts on the football this week. And that's all we've got time for on this week's show. Went so quickly, as always. Thank you for listening to us on Dublin's Talking Sport here on Sunshine 106.8 with thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. Thanks to the producer, Blaine O'Hara, all of our guests who joined us on the show today. We'll be back again next week. Take care, stay safe, and happy Easter.